Morning. We're delighted to welcome some students with us for this case. We have students from Xavier High School. Would those students please stand? Thank you for coming this morning. You may be seated. And we have students from Oregon High School. Would those students stand? And I want to thank you on behalf of the court for coming. You may be seated. The students are here with a Court with Class program that's sponsored by the State Bar in this court. Students from across the state are invited to come and listen to an oral argument. If they agree to come, the students are given briefs about the case and sometimes engage in activities related to the case. We then come to oral argument, listen to oral argument, and after the second oral argument of the day the students appear, they will meet with a justice of this court. And the subject of discussion is the procedure of the case, not the substance of the case. Everyone is welcome to join the students after this case in that discussion with the justice. So let me introduce the court to you all. Starting on my far right is Justice Lewis Butler. Seated next to him is Justice David Prosser. Seated to my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my left is Justice Patrick Crooks. And to his left, Justice Patience Rogensack. And then there's an empty chair on the far left, and ordinarily Justice Annette Ziegler sits there, but she is not participating in this case. With those introductions made, I will now call the second case of today, 06AP1062D, Office of Lawyer Regulation versus Jeffrey Elvelman. Representing the Office of Lawyer Regulation is Attorney Robert Crone. Mr. Crone.
Thank you. May it please the Court, it's always an honor and a privilege to appear before your honors. There's a touch of sadness in my argument this morning because this case has seen the passing of two heavyweights in the legal profession that were closely involved in this case. Patrick Ryan, who was the chairman and managing partner of Quarles & Brady and a key witness on behalf of OLR, and attorney Dan Hildebrand, as we all know, a skilled advocate on behalf of the respondent. OLR has, the OLR director has authorized this appeal of findings of a referee, and we recognize this is one of those rare instances where OLR has appealed, where the standard of the appellate process is that of a clearly erroneous determination by a referee. We recognize that this is a difficult burden to meet, but we feel this is one of those rare instances where a referee did make clearly erroneous findings. And under the Holman case, the standard of clearly erroneous, although it's rather nebulous, states essentially that there is an erroneous view of the facts, a lack of a rational basis or process to reach a conclusion, or the reaching of a conclusion which is a reasonable fact finder would not reach. In this case, the essential facts are basically undisputed. Mr. Elvelman had been with Quarles & Brady since 1992, a partner since 1995. When he became a partner, he signed a statement indicating that he would be bound by the terms of a partnership agreement. He received three other partnership agreements during his time at Quarles & Brady. And the partnership agreements unequivocally stated that, among other things, trustee fees received in the practice of law by a partner were the property of Quarles & Brady and were to be paid over to Quarles & Brady. Other undisputed facts are that for 5 years, Mr. Elvelman helped himself to those fees, totaling close to approximately $230,000, $250,000, that were not paid back to Quarles & Brady's. And that during the pertinent years in question, 99 to 2004, he chose not to report that amount of money or any of it on his income tax returns. The practices of Quarles & Brady, there was undisputed that no one in the history of that firm, according to the managing executive partner, Mr. Ryan and others, ever kept trustee fees by themselves. That the practice was clear and unambiguous. There was never a need to have seminars, memos, or advisory information on the subject. And another critical fact in this case that I'll touch more upon in the argument is it's undisputed that at some, well, it is disputed, but we think a key fact here is that a paralegal, Ms. Kostner, not to be confused with the Kastner Trust, told Mr. Elverman early in the process that it was her understanding that fees were to be paid to the firm.
Counselor, that would be a credibility determination, which would be very difficult for us to get behind. But what I am interested in regard to your argument about the clearly erroneous standard that you're trying to meet, is whether these trusts or the person for whose behalf they were established was a client of Mr. Elverman before he came to the firm.
I frankly don't recall the facts on that. That was not a fact that was
there's nothing in the record
about a lot of attention in the record. And
okay.
He was a client. This was a trust and a client of the firm at the time that he was.
But he didn't have a relationship in the past where he had been receiving money from that particular client before he came
to the firm. I don't believe there was any testimony on that subject, but I think that is the case.
Okay.
And I would say that when you talk about Ms. Kostner's testimony, that is a credibility issue. That's one of those so-called credibility issues that I think if you look behind the reasoning for the credibility determination, you can find that determination was clearly erroneous. And I'll get to that in a minute.
But if it's a credibility determination, do we use the clearly erroneous standard, or is it incredible as a matter of law?
Well, I think it's still the clearly erroneous standard. That's a semantical difference, perhaps. But
The reason I ask the question is usually when you get behind credibility determinations, it has to be contrary to the fully established facts or the physical facts of nature. And so it seems to be a harder standard than just clearly erroneous, unless I'm misreading it.
Well, if you look at the total context of the facts in this case, and you look and you zero in on that testimony of that witness, it seems to be an incredible to reach the conclusion and single out that testimony and say it's convincing and then say it's not to be believed. And if you look at the rationale behind the acceptance of Mr. Elverman's testimony compared to that paralegal, you find out that the rationale essentially was, well, yes, she was a convincing witness. Yes, she didn't have a motive to lie. Yes, she was a paralegal and not a supervisor. And the reason we don't believe her, the referee said, or the reason I don't believe her, is because if she was telling the truth, then Mr. Elverman's practices would have been different. He would have, at that point in time, acted more secretively, or would have covered up the taking of trustee fees, or would have hidden that fact from his partners. He didn't do that. And for that reason, I choose to disbelieve Ms. Kostner. For many reasons, I think that's an irrational type of analysis of the facts to arrive at a credibility determination, because as our position is in this case, the system at Quarles and Brady was so open and so dependent upon trust of partners, and there was no independent monitoring of what partners did, that atmosphere and that system created a situation where Mr. Elverman could take advantage of the situation, knew he wouldn't be caught, although he was eventually, and then maintain a position of what I think to be plausible deniability, if you will, down the road.
The firm knew. People in the firm knew he was pocketing the fees because the firm's trust accounting division, right, did keep track of this trust or these trusts. As I understand it, a partner could, if he was a trustee or involved in a trust, hire somebody on the outside to audit and keep the accounts, or use the firm's accounting.
Yes.
They use the firm's, right?
That's right.
And those records in the firm showed payments to him, right?
The records did, but the knowledge of those records and the monitoring or the review of those records was not known to the partners. It may have been known internally to the people doing the book work, but it was not known to his partners.
So, and you, your position then is that that knowledge should not be imposed on the partners in the partnership?
No, no, that's correct.
The agent's knowledge is not to be put to the
No, I don't think these people who are doing the ministerial or bookkeeping tasks, I don't think should be charged with knowledge of the partnership terms or agreements, or should, or that the partner should be held to be bound by whatever they know.
You may have answered this, but I'm sorry. So I will ask it again so I'm clear in my own mind. Was Mr. Elverman trustee or co-trustee of other trusts?
No, he not at Quarles and Brady. The record is that there was one other case that he had served as a trustee and one other matter that he had served as a trustee in. And
in another firm or at Q&B?
At Q&B.
And did he take fees on that one?
That case didn't involve trustee fees. It involved what he described as attorney fees. And they were turned into the firm.
Okay.
The other undisputed facts here that we think are critical and were really not analyzed is the fact that he didn't report the income on his tax returns for several years. The failure to, the willingness, if you will, to claim that this is my money, and then the unwillingness to even report them on tax returns by a trained accountant seems to me to be something that this referee should have taken note of. They clearly
What does it tell you? Does it tell you that he thought the money wasn't his, or does it tell you that he just didn't think that $70,000 would be spotted? You know, he has probably has a high income. And, you know, the penalties under the IRS for not reporting depend on the percent or the amount, I've forgotten, of the not reported sum compared to the income you do report. So if you fail to report $50 and you got jillions, you know, no one's going to clip you on it. If you report 50 cents and you got jillions unreported, you got a problem.
Well, his contention in this case, which we thought was beyond the pale, if you will, is that he forgot about the fact that this money had to be reported in the first couple of years, 99 and 2000. Then he realized it was to be reported, but he chose not to report it. So he came to a conclusion, yes, this is around 2001, I believe, or 2002, and then for 2 or 3 years, even knowing that it was reportable income, he chose not to report. He said he had other obligations, family obligations, other financial obligations. And the clearly erroneous oversights here, if you will, or determinations by this referee, she failed to ignore, or she ignored the importance of the critical document. That is the partnership agreement. The undisputed facts that this is a partnership agreement that he signed as a trained, skilled professional. And he claims, well, he glossed over it and shouldn't be bound by it. He is a CPA. He is a lawyer. And our point is that as a matter of law, simple contract law, seems to me one cannot be excused from the terms of a contract simply by saying I didn't study it in detail.
How was this issue discovered?
Discovered?
Yeah.
It was discovered because there were some other issues involving Mr. Elverman at the Quarles and Brady firm, other complaints that were not brought out in this case that were going to lead to his withdrawal from the firm. And in the context of concerns and considerations of those other issues, they did an investigation of his practice in its entirety and determined that he was taking these trustee fees. And that led to the meeting with Mr. Ryan and his ultimate withdrawal from the law firm on an expedited basis, if you will. He left earlier than would have otherwise been the case.
Do I understand, Mr. Crone, that all of the trustee fees were issued as checks by Quarles and Braid to him?
Trustees' fees would have been paid from the trust directly through the office to him.
I mean, was there a check?
Checks, and he would then deposit them in his own personal accounts.
So the checks were made out to him, not to Q and B, correct?
The checks would have been, as I recall, would have been made out to him.
Thank you.
We had a petition that this court
at his request, I believe. I'm sorry.
We had a petition, and I think it's still pending, to regulate paralegals. And one of the issues there, as I recall, was the duty of paralegals to basically report ethical violations by their bosses. And that was a very sensitive issue. But it seems to me if Quarles and Braid was issuing checks to the man, somebody wouldn't have had to go and say, I think he's taking fees. They could have gotten copies of those checks or pictures.
Well, there had been instances where checks had been issued to attorneys' trustee fees, and then the practice was for the attorneys to endorse the check back to the firm. That had occurred. And the fact of the matter is that it was an unambiguous provision in his contract that was followed by every partner there. There was no ambiguity amongst the partners that was what was to be done. And wasn't done by him. Now, the fact and their defenses, the fact that this was open or obvious to others who might have looked at it, the fact is Quarles and Braid did not operate that way. They operated on trust, and they never had any problems with this issue. So they didn't check one another, and they didn't have subordinates or employees check one another and report different things. That was the system that they had in place.
I assume this check was on the trust. So it may have been signed by somebody in Q&B, but it was a separate account in Q&B, not a Q&B account.
It came out of the trust.
Okay.
Yeah.
Which is, I mean, is it like a separate fiduciary services wing of Quarles and Braid?
Yes, there's a fiduciary department, accounting department, and so forth, and it would be a separate wing.
I don't mean department. Physically. I mean, does Quarles and Braid have a fiduciary services department such that it retains the trusts, it charges fees on the trusts, as opposed to in the good old days when the banks all had the trusts and the law firms didn't keep the trusts in-house? That's what I'm looking for.
Well, they charged, they have different systems depending upon the nature of the estate. There were attorney's fees as well as trustee fees charged on this account.
Mm-hmm. It used to, I mean, I might be wrong, but I think that it used to be, that's why, you know, all the banks had trust departments, and all the banks had trust departments, and the estate planning documents all indicated that, you know, M&I is going to be the trustee or First American or whatever the bank is. But my sense is now that Quarles and Braid has their own trust organization within the law firm. Is that correct?
Well, their firm can serve as trustee, and individual attorneys can serve as trustee. Many times co-trustees are banks. Many times exclusive trustees are banks. But in this instance, Mr. Alverman served as a co-trustee with a family member, and our point of our brief was that this created what we thought to be a perfect storm. This was a family member who was also receiving comparable amounts described as being exorbitant trustee fees.
Where were the trust fees held? Who managed the trusts?
Well, the trust was managed by Quarles and Braid through Mr. Alverman. Essentially, Mr. Alverman managed it. The clearly additional erroneous findings we feel from the referee were the means by which he came to a conclusion that somehow there was confusion at Quarles and Braid regarding these trustee fees. The record doesn't support any such finding. Mr. Ryan, the managing partner for some 40 years, and Mr. Tillman and the executive committee, again said that there were no other instances of attorneys keeping trustee fees. Never was it such an issue at the firm to be the subject of the need to have a subject of seminars or memos. It was an open system. There was no confusion amongst partners at all. There was no evidence of any confusion. The referee put great weight on the fact that Ms. Costner testified that she had heard that some attorneys, two unidentified attorneys, somehow had a special agreement to retain trustee fees. This was hearsay, rank hearsay testimony that was admissible, was admitted by the referee, was not admissible, and apparently served as a basis for one of her determinations that there was confusion. The referee also pointed out that some attorneys got trustee fees paid to them and then endorsed those checks to the firm. That's true. That occurred on a couple of occasions. But there was no confusion over that practice. The fact of the matter is, wherever these fees went, they ultimately were for services performed by a lawyer at the firm, and they were the firm's property and turned back to the firm.
Counselor, I'd like you to switch over to recommended discipline for a minute. Just say, for sake of argument, that we don't think you've been able to show us that the referee's findings were clearly erroneous. Would OLR's recommendation for discipline change based on that stance of the case as a hypothetical?
Well, there is a second count in this case, and that's the tax count.
Yes, I understand that. That's why
OLR's,
I'm asking.
OLR's position, if you look at that count alone, if we're looking at that count alone, we feel that that recommended discipline is totally inadequate, a public reprimand, given the circumstances here.
What would you recommend?
We were recommending a short-term suspension up to 6 months, quite honestly, in that situation. And the reasons for that are that the amounts involved are significant. We're talking about $250,000 over 5 years, taken by a man who's trained as an accountant, who knows the tax laws, who knows the system, who simply claims to have forgotten about the need to report them, and then chose not to report them when he suddenly had a revelation that, yes, this is taxable income, I should be reporting this. If the cases can be tracked in this situation, we acknowledge that there are some public reprimand cases and relating to 28.4F violations. There are also some suspensions. And the fact that the suspension cases are somewhat parallel to this, and I think an important case is the Washington case cited in our brief, where there was an 18-month suspension for similar conduct. Now, the violation might not have been a 28.4F violation, but the underlying conduct is basically not reporting income. And Ms. Washington
got an 18-month... Did she fail to file there?
I'm sorry?
Did Hazel Washington fail to file?
Yeah, she failed to report on her tax returns income. And essentially the government wasn't advised of her income, a fair amount of her income.
So why should she get 18 months and this guy gets 6?
Well, I think an argument could be made for as much as 18 months suspension in this case. And Ms. Washington, like Mr. Elverman, had no prior discipline. The amounts involved in the Elverman case, the instant case, are significantly more than in the Washington case. And the level of sophistication and knowledge of the laws by the respective respondents, Ms. Washington and Mr. Elverman, are greatly different. Mr. Elverman knew what his obligations were and chose to ignore them over a long period of time, and there's a egregious, if you will, conscious disregard of the law in terms of his obligation to report and pay taxes. He ultimately did do that, and you'll hear that. He was not prosecuted criminally. I don't think that should make any difference whether some U.S. attorney chose to prosecute him and chose to prosecute Ms. Washington and not him. That's not something that we have any control over. But that violation in and of itself, the tax violation, we believe warrants a significant suspension. I mentioned 6 months. The Washington case is 18 months. Something within that range we believe to be appropriate because of the unique circumstances here. Coming back to count one, We also feel that the referee was clearly erroneous in her analysis of this case by simply not considering certain undisputed testimony. When Mr. Ellerman was confronted by his executive partner, Mr. Ryan, about the situation in his office, Mr. Ellerman was seen to be nervous and upset and acknowledged that he took the funds and stated that he only wanted to take advantage of Quarles and Brady. That was a statement that he made to Mr. Ryan when he was caught, essentially. Now, in his testimony, he was asked about that statement, and he first said he didn't recall it, and then he said, well, that doesn't sound like something I would have said. But that was very strong testimony, a very strong indication of an admission of wrongdoing here, and the referee simply didn't even comment upon that in her report. That I thought was a significant oversight of a very critical issue in terms of the underlying situation here. The other thing is that I think the referee is clearly erroneous in not seeing the overlap, if you will, between counts one and count two. The fact that the underlying conduct here and the purpose of the conduct is not only to take money that's not yours and to deprive the trust of money, which was exorbitant, to deprive your partners of the money, contrary to the terms of the agreement, but also to deprive the government of the tax implications of this money. That seems to me to show, if you will, a state of mind of one who simply wants to take advantage of the system from start to finish, to help oneself to the funds and not to report it. So as I indicated, in terms of, I understand that the court sets a very high bar in terms of this clearly erroneous standard, but any fair review of this transcript and some of these significant oversights and some of these findings that there was confusion amongst the partners or a lack of consistency of the policy. My gosh, the head partners of the firm that had been there for a long time talked about the fact that this was clearly in the terms of the agreement, never disputed or argued by anyone. It was consistently written out in every agreement that was signed by Mr. Ellerman or received, never debated, and followed religiously by everybody. Now, how this referee could have concluded that there was a lack of consistency in following this policy is beyond our understanding. The only lack of consistency is that Mr. Ellerman is the only one who chose to violate it.
Procedurally, was OLR able to ask for reconsideration before the referee, overlooking certain facts?
No, we did not do that. It's rare that such a motion, at least to my experience, is ever undertaken. We thought that there were determinations made that there was not a rational basis for the logic used to come to the conclusion that this credibility determination should be made was flawed in a number of respects, and that there was a couple of key points that the referee simply didn't address in her report.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Crone. Mr. Rainey, representing Jeffrey Ellerman.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm here today on behalf of Mr. Ellerman. We have a very different view of the facts and the findings in this case than Mr. Crone does. We're here to ask that the court uphold the referee's findings and the referee's recommendation. The evidence simply does not support OLR's argument that Mr. Ellerman acted deceitfully or dishonestly, or that his conduct is in any way deserving of the drastic remedy of suspension or revocation of his license. Referee Peterson, who heard all of the facts, who viewed the witnesses as they testified at the hearing, made credibility determinations and evaluated all of the evidence, found first that OLR failed to prove by clear and convincing evidence, or for that matter failed to prove at all, that Mr. Ellerman retained trustee fees with fraudulent or deceitful intent. Therefore, referee Peterson concluded there was no violation of 28.4C. The referee was right. Second, referee, as to the tax issue, Mr. Elverman stipulated in the case that he had violated 20.8.4 sub F by failing to include income in his previously filed tax returns. There was no dispute about that. The only issue before the court is what is the appropriate measure of discipline for that violation. The referee found in making her recommendation for a public reprimand that Mr. Elverman had amended his tax returns, had paid taxes on the trustee fees before OLR ever notified him during the investigation that it was concerned about the tax issue. The referee noted in her recommendations that, quote, there have been several cases where a public reprimand was imposed despite facts more egregious than those involved here. Therefore, referee Peterson concluded that a public reprimand was appropriate.
Again, what does the record show as to the inducement to amend the tax returns? Was it Q&B's or the law firm's investigation?
All that the record shows, Your Honor, is that Mr. Elverman testified that until 2002, he simply forgot, did not realize that he had to report the trustee fees as income on his tax returns. When he did realize that in 2002, he was in a situation where he had a hard choice to make. As he testified, essentially, I looked around and it was time to file my tax returns. I'm quoting from page 183 of the hearing transcript. I had a lot of other family obligations. I needed to take care of kids going to college, high school tuition, braces. And at that point, he says, I had to make a decision. Do we take the kids out of school or do I pay these taxes later on?
There might have been another option, Counselor, like borrow some money from a bank. Maybe that was a better choice than to borrow it from the government.
Your Honor, he has admitted a violation. Certainly one can quarrel with the decision he made. I'm not trying to excuse it, but the issue here essentially is how egregious is his conduct? What is the appropriate?
Well, when did he amend the returns?
Right.
I'm sorry?
When did he amend the returns?
He filed amended returns in early 2005.
Okay. What was going on in the rest of his life?
He apparently had hard choices to make. He had heavy family financial commitments. As he testified, he had school tuition to pay, dental expenses, other things. Apparently did not have enough money to both take care of his family and pay taxes.
Is that 2005, too?
In 2005, he filed amended tax
right.
returns and paid the taxes that were due on the trustee fees plus interest.
I know. Was he under investigation then by the law firm?
I don't know what he knew about being investigated by the law firm. He had been called in by Mr. Ryan, the managing partner, I believe, in the fall of 2004, about 6 months before, and told, we've got some concerns about what you're doing.
So he knew he had problems with the firm. Did they say what their concerns were? Is that in the record?
They did not talk with him about tax issues, and I think there's no reason they would. What the record shows is Mr. Ryan said, we have taken a look at records within the firm, and we have determined that you have been receiving trustee fees, which haven't been paid over to the firm.
So he knew he had a problem with trustee fees in 2005. In 2004, before he amended the returns.
Yes, that's true.
So now he has a problem with the law firm that he took their money, and he has a problem with IRS that he didn't report it. And he knows that, and so in 2005 he reports it. And how much taxes does he pay? Is that in the record?
That is not in the record,
okay.
Your Honor. What is in the record is that he paid the back taxes in full with the interest that he computed to be due.
Is it in the record where he got this money all of a sudden when he was in straits 3 years prior?
It is in the record that he was in straits 3 years prior.
I know, but where did he come up with the money, 2005?
That is not in
not in the record. Okay.
But did he take a deduction on all of those things?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, deduction for what?
Well, he had to pay $230,000 back to the law firm.
That is not in the record.
Isn't that in Mr. Hildebrand's letter?
I don't believe it's in the record.
Counsel, earlier a question was asked whether or not
Mr. Elverman brought the trust to the firm, or that the trusts were already in the firm, and Mr. Elverman merely assigned as the attorney on the trust. Do you know the answer to that?
My understanding, I don't. My understanding is Quarles and Brady's fiduciary accounting department signed the checks and turned them over to Mr. Elverman, if that's what you're asking.
I think I'm not clear in my question. Finding of fact number 7 says Donald Kastner retained Quarles and Brady to handle various legal matters concerning his estate planning, including 3 trusts. Mr. Elverman was the attorney assigned to the file. Another finding of fact says that the Kastner matter, this is finding 11, the Kastner matter was the first matter where Mr. Elverman actually administered an estate and trust and acted as a fiduciary. So the question arises, did Mr. Elverman bring Kastner and his trust to the firm when he came to the firm of Quarles and Brady, or were Kastner and his trusts already clients of Quarles and Brady, and that he was assigned by someone at Quarles and Brady to handle the trusts and be the trustee?
I believe what the record says is that the Kastner trust matter first arose while Mr. Elverman was at Quarles and Brady. The record is not clear as to whether the Kastner family was a prior client of either Quarles and Brady or Mr. Elverman. That's not clear. If I may continue on, I'd like to go back to the trustee fees issue and discuss that. Again, Mr. Crone has said that he believes that the referee committed clear error by finding that there was no deceit, no misrepresentation. I would submit that, on the contrary, the evidence is overwhelming that what happened here is Mr. Elverman made an honest mistake. Facts I'd like the court to consider are this. First of all,
counsel, can I ask you about one of those facts? The one thing that appears troubling, and I've been going through and I've looked at the referee's findings, the facts and conclusions of law, and I don't see anything on this. But on page 17 of Mr. Crone's brief, at the bottom of the page, there's an indication that following Mr. Elverman's resignation, he approached Kastner and requested that she remove the Kastner files from Quarles and Brady and bring them to Elverman at a location outside of the firm. She refused to do so. I looked at the findings, and I looked at the conclusions, and unless I'm missing something, I don't see any finding one way or the other with respect to that by the referee. And I'm wondering if that's something that either should have been or maybe shouldn't have been considered by the referee in making a determination regarding the question of honesty.
I think you're correct, Your Honor, that there was no finding made on that. There is evidence in the record also that the Kastner family asked Mr. Elverman, I believe, to continue working for them after Mr. Elverman left Quarles and Brady.
Okay.
Mr. Elverman wanted to get the file in order to do that. I
got it.
Probably
right.
Shouldn't presume to what the referee was thinking, but I would say
but
I think
that's
that she probably
record.
Thought it was not a very material fact to the issues before her.
All right. Thank you.
In looking at the partnership agreement, which there was a finding that he received and signed and et cetera, I'm looking at the respondent's appendix, page 17. And the language is clear, or pretty clear. Fees payable to the partner for serving as a trustee under a trust agreement or as a personal representative of the estate of a decedent and all other remuneration or income of any nature whatsoever received by any partner in consideration of the practice of law or the performance of legal services shall be turned over to the firm and shall constitute partnership income. Seems relatively clear. And so there's something to be said on one side of the balance that why shouldn't the attorney, as a matter of law, be held to know
what's in his partnership agreement. It's a contract. He signed it acknowledging that, I don't know if he acknowledged that he read and understood it. I think he signed something that said that he received it. I can't remember the exact wording of the paper that he signed. But why shouldn't we, as a matter of law, impute knowledge to him, since it's a contract and the language is clear, and since he's an attorney?
I have a two-part answer, Justice Bradley. One is that it might seem intuitive to many people that attorneys do read their contracts, but the evidence in the record and the referee's findings of fact indicate that, rightly or wrongly, that is not always the case. For example, Mr. Ryan, the managing partner of Quarles & Brady, testified, typically people at Quarles & Brady do not fly-spec their partner agreements. Mr. Tilleman, at one time head of the Trust and Estates Department at Quarles & Brady, testified that when he became a partner, he simply skimmed through the agreement.
Well,
I think, if I just may real quickly, sure. The second point I wanted to make is, in hindsight, should he have read it? He should have. But the issue here is not whether he breached the contract. When it was brought to his attention that he had not paid over the trustee fees, he did not try to object, he did not try to fight it, he recognized his mistake, he paid the money back.
The
issue here is discipline, not breach of contract.
Are his time records in the record? I mean, to earn $50,000 a year as a trustee, you got to put in some time, right? How much was he paid per hour by the trust, or didn't it work that way?
That is not in the record, Your
okay.
Honor.
But he had to put in some time. That time was either done on office time or was done not on office time. Was done on office time, why isn't that part of the of what the firm gets from you? Let me just tell you, when I practiced law, which is a long time ago, in a small firm, we didn't have a partnership, written partnership agreement. But if any of the partners got any sort of income or any sort of money that didn't flow from the usual client base, they reported that to the partnership and said, you think this is part of the partnership pot that I should kick in, or can I keep it? I mean, that was standard operating procedure. Just because people know you're on 24/7, and even if you're not on 24/7 as a lawyer, you owe something. So it just seems to me, whether he read this contract or not, he had to know that a sum like 50 grand, which entails a lot of his time, that the partnership might have some interest in it. I mean, this is the same question as Justice Bradley asked about imputing knowledge. How can he not know that? Counsel?
Your Honor, what the evidence does indicate and what the referee looked at was the fact that there are all sorts of different arrangements. There are many activities out there which can be firm activities, can be clearly non-firm activities, can be in the gray area. The referee found fairly detailed findings of fact that it was not clear within Quarles and Brady what has to be reported here.
That's right. And if it's not clear, isn't his obligation to check it out with the firm?
The referee found, and the factual efforts supports the finding, that he simply did not understand that he had to pay them over. His understanding, rightly or wrongly, it turned out wrongly, was that he did not. But it was not intentional deceit. There was no intent to cover up. There's not a shred of evidence saying that Mr. Elverman said to himself, yes, I know I have to pay these over either by custom or by contract, but you know what? I'm going to cover it up and hope I can get away with it. There is not a shred of evidence to support that.
Why should he get less of a discipline than Ms. Washington?
Because In the Washington case, a couple of things. As Mr. Crone noted, Ms. Washington, unlike Mr. Elverman, was subject to criminal prosecution. She received a fairly stiff sentence from the Eastern District of Wisconsin. More importantly, Your Honor, if you look at the facts, Ms. Washington, unlike Mr. Elverman, engaged in an intentional cover-up. The record, as reported in the case, shows that her accountant repeatedly told her, look, if you've got other income out there, you need to include that in your tax returns. The record showed Ms. Washington went to considerable efforts to put the money in separate accounts. It's clear from the record she intentionally did not tell her accountant, even though she was actually on notice she had to do that. There was a cover-up here.
But, counsel, if I can follow the chief's question, for the first couple of years, my understanding is that that was also Mr. Alberman's position, but at some point he became aware of his obligation to report, and as I understand it, did not. Now, does that not take it into the realm of intentional non-disclosure?
Again, Justice Butler, a two-part answer. He has stipulated to a violation. The only question is, what is the appropriate discipline? As I quoted earlier, when he realized in 2002 that he had to report this, he was in what he viewed as a very difficult dilemma. Either I can pay the taxes or I can take care of my family. He decided, rightly or wrongly, to take care of his family first.
I understand that, but
problem later.
No, I understand that, but your distinction was that in Ms. Washington's case, there was an intentional nondisclosure here, and at least from 2002, maybe I'm not seeing the distinction anymore. I understand the argument that for the first couple of years, he either forgot or did not know he had to, but once he was aware that he had to and then did not report, does that not put him in similar shoes as Ms. Washington with respect to the intent aspect of it?
I think the distinction is that the record showed Ms. Washington never intended to report this income. She meant to cover it up and try never to have to report it. The record in Mr. Elverman's case showed, yes, he did delay a couple of years even after he realized that he had to pay, but there's no evidence he intended never to pay ever. The evidence is he said, I'll take care of my family, but when I can, I will pay the taxes.
Who prepared the tax returns, Mr. Elverman, or did somebody else?
I believe the record shows that somebody else did.
So he did not disclose to somebody else these fees, even after 2002?
He disclosed them for purposes of preparing the amended returns that were filed in 2005. So, yes, he did disclose to his accountant.
Counselor, he received fees in 2003 and 2004. Were they reported on his tax returns? Because you said in 2002 he realized he should have been reporting the trustees' fees.
Your Honor, my understanding is that as to the 2004 fees, those were reported on his 2004 tax return, which was filed in early 05. The 2003 fees were not reported until an amended return was filed in early 2005.
But he did know in 2002 that he should have been reporting those trustee fees, unless I misunderstood what you just said.
That is correct.
Okay. So at least he had them for a year when he knew he should be reporting them, and he still didn't. The 2003 fees were current fees. They wouldn't have required an amended return, just a disclosure, correct?
I believe that's correct.
Thank you.
I would like to say also, I was asked about the Washington case. OLR has cited a number of cases, including the Washington, but not limited to the Washington case, arguing that a significant suspension should be imposed here. I think it's important to urge the court to take a look at cases which are much closer, we believe, on the facts to the situation than the cases that OLR cites. I would cite the court in particular to the Lex and the Young cases, which are discussed quite extensively in our brief. I think in particular I would submit that the facts in Lex, while not identical, are quite similar to a situation we have here. This is a situation, Mr. Elverman did not fail to file tax returns. The conduct at issue here is simply failure to report some of his income on the tax returns for certain years. In Attorney Lex's case, he failed to file timely returns at all for 4 years. He, unlike Mr. Elverman, received repeated notices from the Wisconsin Department of Revenue that that he should file. Here, Mr. Elverman never received any notice from the taxing authorities and, frankly, has never heard from the taxing authorities since he did amend his returns. It appears, judging from the lack of response from the DOR and the IRS, that they consider once Mr. Elverman paid the extra taxes and paid his interest, the matter was at an end. In any event, in the Lex case, Mr. Lex, like Mr. Elverman, also his conduct was due in part to the fact that he had financial hardships. In Lex and in this case, hardships certainly do not excuse the failure to comply with your legal obligations, but the Lex case indicates that it is a mitigating factor for the court to consider. Again, unlike the Washington case, this is not a case where Mr. Elverman never intended to pay the taxes, intended to cover it up permanently. Or at all. This is a case where Mr. Elverman, yes, did realize in 2002 that he did have to pay the taxes. He had a hard choice to make at that point between family and taxes, but there is no evidence he intended to pay the taxes when he could. He did not intend to hide them forever.
Are you familiar with the Phillips case? That's okay if you're not. I'm not all that familiar either. That's why I asked you.
We cited in our brief, did we not?
Yeah, that's right. But I just don't recall all the facts of Phillips.
Let me take a look at that.
I think that he got a 3-year suspension for tax-related stuff. That's my.
I'm sorry, Justice Bradley. I don't see it, and I am not recalling.
That's fine.
I'd like to make one other point on the tax issue. OLR in its briefs suggests that imposing a public reprimand is not a significant discipline. In essence, they're saying it's a slap on the wrist. It's nothing more than that. I would like to make the point to the court that public reprimand is far from a slap on the wrist. It is not a penalty that is light. It is not a penalty that is to be taken lightly. If this court accepts the referee's recommendation and imposes a public reprimand on Mr. Elverman, that is going to be a permanent stain, a permanent scar on Mr. Elverman's record. This will be a published decision of this court. This will be in the Wisconsin reports forever. Anybody who is interested in the public records can tomorrow, a year from now, 10, 100 years from now, read those records. That, unfortunately, will be part of Mr. Elverman's legacy. This is something he is going to have to live with. And I think it is important for purposes of one of the goals that the court has to try to achieve in imposing discipline is to send a message to the public that a particular type of conduct, if committed, will result in a particular type of sanction, will not be condoned. It's important to send the message to the public and the legal community that you should not do this. If you do, there will be consequences. A public reprimand is a serious consequence. Again, it will be a permanent stain on Mr. Elverman's record. I would submit, particularly given the fact that Mr. Elverman has never been before this court on disciplinary proceedings before, no prior record. There were many witnesses who testified as to his good character in other matters. This will be something that will be taken very seriously by him. It is certainly consistent with cases like the Lex case, the many other tax cases where this court has deemed a public reprimand to be an appropriate discipline. This will be more than adequate to send a message to the public and to the legal community that this is the standard you must follow. This will be more than sufficient to deter Mr. Elverman and other members of the bar from future conduct. They know what the consequences will be. They will not take a public reprimand lightly. I think I see my time is almost up. I'd just like to make a couple of additional remarks going back to the trustee fees issue, if I may. A couple of quick points. I think it is important to note that the referee found a large number of facts, which in the referee's opinion showed that Mr. Elverman had no intent to deceive Quarles and Brady, had no intent to misrepresent his retention of trustee fees to Quarles and Brady. One point that Mr. Krohn emphasized very heavily and that OLR has emphasized in its briefs, OLR's case is in large part based on testimony of Ms. Koster, specifically testimony of hers that she told Mr. Elverman trustee fees were to be paid to Quarles and Brady. He then said to her essentially, I'll write a memo on it. Now, that is one of the things that Mr. Krohn says means, well, that so you have to believe this, and this had to be intentional. Mr. Krohn also makes the point that the referee in her decision says this is, quote, perhaps the most convincing evidence of fraud. It should be remembered that language has to be read in context. The referee was not saying, I find this convinces me that fraud took place. This is at page A106 of OLR's appendix. This statement follows a lengthy recitation by the referee of various facts showing that, in fact, Mr. Elverman did not engage in any intentional misrepresentation or deceit. The referee found Mr. Elverman genuinely did not read his contract, did not know this was his obligation. The referee found there was no clear policy within Quarles and Brady, making clear to everybody that trustee fees must be turned over. The referee also noted Mr. Elverman testified, contradicted Ms. Koster's account of this conversation. He said that the conversation never happened. The referee was the finder of fact. She heard the witnesses. She was entitled to weigh the evidence, determine what facts actually happened. The referee found and explained in some detail, I find that this conversation did not take place. Again, the standard here is the referee, in order to impose discipline, in order to find that there was a violation of 8.4 sub C, the OLR had to show, not just by the preponderance of the evidence, but by clear and convincing evidence, that Mr. Elverman acted deceitfully and dishonestly, not just that he breached the terms of his partnership agreement, but that he acted deceitfully and dishonestly. The referee found that the evidence not only did not show this by clear and convincing evidence, but that the evidence as a whole did not show this. It was an honest mistake. Mr. Elverman paid the firm back when the mistake was brought to his attention. As it turned out, Mr. Elverman was never compensated one dime for the services that it's undisputed he did perform for the trust. He gave it all back to Quarles and Brady. And with that, I think I have said all I have to say. If the court has any additional questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Thank you, Mr. Rainey. Mr. Krohn.
Thank you. Members of the court, there are a couple of things I heard that I'm a little bit astounded by. One suggestion that Mr. Elverman had some kind of financial hardship at the time that he chose not to pay his taxes. This is a partner at Quarles and Brady, former partner, who's taking about $50,000 a year out of this one trust alone. And the other suggestion is that somehow or another, in April of 2005, he had a revelation that maybe I should now pay these taxes, and that he made some personal decisions not to earlier. He paid those taxes because OLR had started their investigation. On page 5 of our reply brief sets forth a scenario of the timeline here that the Chief Justice seemed to be interested in. OLR had started its investigation and had communicated with Mr. Elverman in January of 2005 about the trust issues. Of course, they had already been investigated by his partner, former partners at Quarles and Brady. And then four or five months later, he paid the taxes. And don't try to convince me that this was some form of a hardship. This was a conscious choice on his part to take the money and not to pay the taxes on it. Furthermore, knowledge of the terms of an agreement. My gosh, we got the agreement, several agreements. He signs. Knowledge can be inferred from circumstances. That's in the code. The disciplinary rules can be inferred from the circumstances. This referee, I think, in addition to omitting certain findings that Justice Butler referred to one and I referred to others, also imposed upon us an extra burden of proving an intent to deceive, which I think goes beyond what the scope of the rules are and the law is, as defined by this court, particularly in the Marks case. We don't have to prove a cover-up. We don't have to prove actual intent, however subjective that may be. We have to, this is not a gray area, as counsel, in all due respect, suggests. This is a partnership agreement. He's a partner. He signed for it. He was even told about its provisions. Now we have to prove that he intended to violate it. I don't think that's what Marx holds. Marx is a case where this court found a violation of 8.4C based upon an attorney trying to enforce an attorney's lien in a personal injury case. That was a case where all the documentation was above board. There was no effort to deceive or there was no cover-up. And the court said you don't have to prove the tort of conversion or misrepresentation to find an 8.4C violation. You don't have to prove those. That would place an impossible burden upon us. And I, in all due respect to this referee, think that she placed that kind of burden upon us by saying, you haven't proven some kind of active cover-up here. And that's precisely our point. You can steal open and obvious unchecked system. You're still a thief. You can rob a bank without a mask. You're still a bank robber. And this is it seems to me that this referee imposed upon OLR the burden of showing some kind of dead in the night activity where Mr. Elverman was cutting checks to himself, typing out checks, that sort of thing.
Counsel, I have a question for you.
I don't
you.
Think that's required under Marx and other cases. Right. Yes.
I have a question for you regarding discipline. And I understand your argument that should this court reverse with respect to 20:8.4C. But if the court does not reverse, and if we're only looking at the violation under F, I know that you've argued in your brief the Washington case and the Owens case in Kalau. And I want to press you on the discipline with respect to the tax violation, because as I go back and I look at those cases, as I understand Washington, there was a criminal conviction that went along with it. In Kalau, there were multiple violations. And with respect to the Owens case, I think we were talking about a 10-year period, 4 years of non-filing at all and 10 years of either non-filing or late filing. And I'm wondering if we're only dealing with F, whether or not, as Mr. Rainey has argued, the cases that are cited, Lex and Young, might be closer with respect to the factual similarities in this case.
I don't think so. I think if you look at Owens, which as my memory serves, involved a long-term suspension, and if you look at Washington, which had an 18-month suspension, whether there's criminal convictions or not, I don't see the importance of that. The fact of the matter is you have people who are keeping money that belongs to the government.
If I can press you on that, and maybe this goes to the heart of the question, when you have a criminal conviction, as I see it, you have a criminal prosecutor who's made a determination that, by God, this is a crime. It goes through a court of law, and either there's a guilty plea or there's a criminal conviction. And there's a determination that, in fact, somebody has violated the law in that respect. That seems to take it a little bit further than a failure to file. Now maybe I understand the conduct is similar, but
in all due respect, we don't know why there was not a criminal prosecution.
Understand
here.
That.
Could very well be that nobody reported this to a district attorney or to a U.S. attorney.
Okay.
The money was paid back, and the money was paid back to Quarles and Brady, and as soon as they got it, they returned it to the Costners, dollar for dollar. They recognized, and there was a question raised, I think, by the Chief Justice about the amounts involved here. Mr. Tillman, who's in charge of the Trust and Estates Division, said he was astounded by the fees charged in what was a simple trust matter, and that if he, in his years of practice, would have charged or kept trustee fees, he would have made millions every year, and he wouldn't have been there talking to us, I guess, was his point. So the amounts were very significant. And I think those amounts and the knowledge of this defendant, this is not an unsophisticated person. This is a person who knows or should be charged with knowing the tax laws, among other laws, knowing his partnership agreement, to not report $250,000 over 5 years, claim you didn't know you had to do it, and then claim, well, I knew, but I had a hardship. Please, I think this is a clear and an egregious violation of that rule that deserves a suspension and not a slap on the wrist public reprimand. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Crone, and thank you, Mr. Rainey, for your argument in this case. And discipline cases are always difficult for the counsel and for the individuals involved in the court. We appreciate your arguments. That closes our hearing on 06-AP-1062-D, Office of Lawyer Regulations versus Jeffrey L. Elverman. The court is in recess until 1:30 when we'll hear our third case. The students who are staying to hear the discussion with Justice Prosser may stay. Other students may come in. We are in recess.